Good morning. The House Judiciary Subcommittee on Civil Law is in session. We have just a couple of changes in the agenda. I anticipate everything will be heard today, but to accommodate some folks, we will do the following. I'll call first for a public hearing on House Bill 2566 and ask counsel to explain the bill.
Chair Ackerman, members of the committee, House Bill 2566 provides that the Department of Human Services must encourage the use of mediation in cases involving a parent or guardian in a juvenile dependency proceeding in which the child is taken into protective custody or placed in substitute care. This bill is a compromise between parties who originally brought forth House Bill 3078. If you recall, that bill required DHS to offer arbitration in certain cases regarding, among other things, protective custody and substitute care. Because the relating clause of that bill related to arbitration services only, and this compromise deals with mediation, the parties used House Bill 2566 because it has a broader relating clause.
Representative Anderson, please. While he's taking the chair here, let me just make a couple of announcements. After we finish with this bill, we'll go through the Senate bills to accommodate counsel, and then go back into the House bills. We do not have a quorum at this moment to go into work session, but it's my intention that when the quorum materializes, we will do that, even if we have to put some bills down toward the end of the list. I've received word from Representative Worth that she's tied up in a traffic problem in I-5, so she'll be excused until she appears. Representative?
Good morning, Mr. Chair. Thank you. I'd like for you to have Nancy Miller here come with me. We, for the record, I'm Representative Gordon Anderson, District 3, Josephine County. Thank you, Mr. Chair, for hearing this bill again. You heard it in a different iteration as House Bill 3078 on arbitration. And over the last number of weeks, we've been talking on different agencies in regards to the possibility that it would be much better served to go through mediation than through arbitration. The reason I brought this bill and the reason that I mentioned last time in hearing, we found a number of cases where parents feel alienated from the agency who has transitioned their children from the home. The parents, in a number of cases, felt that it was unfair and that it was impossible for them to go into the courts well prepared because their finances were not poverty level where they get indigent defense, nor did they have the money to really afford the attorneys that they needed, or the attorneys at some point dropped out of their cases. Therefore, they were left, they felt, at the mercy of the court and really couldn't be defended equally. Mediation could do that job very, very easily and at great cost savings to the state. One or two of the cases that I sat in on in my county ran up over $50,000 on the state, county, and indigent defense side, and the clients, the constituents, or parents were unable to approach that level. I'm told that by the Judicial Department that mediation oftentimes runs $500 to $1,000. It would save great amounts for the parents, but even greater amounts probably for the state. I'm going to have Nancy Miller speak more about the program that they have been working on that's become very successful. And I think they are very excited, as I am, that this might work out to the best interests of everyone. So thank you for letting us be heard on this case, on this bill again.
Thank you, Representative. Ms. Miller?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Nancy Miller. I'm the Deputy State Court Administrator for Program Operations in the Judicial Department. As Representative Anderson said, we have been running a dependency mediation program in the Judicial Department for about the past 5 years. That program has been funded by federal funds. Those federal funds can no longer fund the program. It's been piloted in four counties We've had a national evaluation done of the program. It was proven to be quite successful. And just let me read you a couple of pieces of data. Our program was new when it was evaluated, so it was compared to a program in Santa Clara, California, in which 98% of the parents said, I got a chance to talk about what I wanted to talk about. 98% said, I felt others understood what I said. 98% said, I understood what we were trying to do in mediation. 99% said, I felt others really listened to what I had to say. And as my colleague Timothy Travis was telling Mr. Anderson, Representative Anderson this morning, we've been in this building for a long time listening to constituents say that, with all due respect, DHS is not listening to what they have to say. Having been a caseworker, I will tell you that I was listening when I was a caseworker. It was very difficult to communicate sometimes, not being a neutral party. So mediation is a way for parents to really feel like they've been heard. We support these amendments, and we'll be working with the co-chair of our Ways and Means Committee to fund a policy package that we currently have in the Judicial Department's budget to move this program statewide. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Are there questions from the committee? I guess you've done a real good job, and I mean that because when the bill came in its first form, it had real problems, and I commend Representative Anderson for staying with it and staying with the agency and coming up with something that I think will really enhance the adjudication process at the juvenile court level. So thank you again for your testimony.
Thank you.
Any further witnesses on House Bill 2566? If not, I will close the public hearing on House Bill 2566, and we still don't have a quorum.
We had it lost.
So we'll come back. We'll come back to that. I'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 272A. Counsel, you want to explain the bill? And I have Sylvia Stevens of the Oregon State Bar as the only witness.
Thank you, Chair Ackerman, members of the committee. Senate Bill 272A comes to us from the Oregon State Bar Board of Governors. This bill would allow the Board of Governors to establish a deadline for filing nominating petitions for the election of the Board of Bar Governors. It also sets forth a process and procedure for the recall of a member of the Board of Governors. The process would require a vote from the existing Board of Bar Governors, and the issue would be referred to that the bar members in that section as to whether or not that member would be recalled. It eliminates the Board of Bar Governors' authority to create local lawyer assistance committees to investigate complaints against lawyers. It allows the bar to authorize state lawyer assistance committees to monitor and supervise a lawyer placed on bar probation or in a diversion program in connection with a bar disciplinary proceeding.
Thank you, counsel. Ms. Stevens.
Thank you, Chair Ackerman and members of the committee. I'm Sylvia Stevens. I'm the Senior Assistant General Counsel of the Oregon State Bar, and I'm here today to talk to you in support of Senate Bill 272A on behalf of the bar. As counsel indicated, there are four issues in the bill that would amend the Bar Act to address governance issues for the bar. The first is to change the Board of Governors' election timeline for the lawyer positions. Currently, the statute requires that nominating petitions be filed 30 days before the election. The bill would substitute language to allow the Board of Governors to establish a deadline. The second change prohibits the bar from holding an election when there's only one candidate, and currently the statute says that an election shall not be held if there's only one candidate. The replacement language says that the board may not conduct an election in that circumstance. Both of these changes are intended to give the Board of Governors some needed flexibility to fashion the details of the election process as circumstances dictate and enhance its ability to govern the affairs of the bar more efficiently. The next change is Board of Governors recall. Currently, the statute has a process for bar members in any region of the of any of the six regions to recall a governor elected from that region. The Senate Bill 272A would add a new provision to ORS 9.050 to permit the Board of Governors to initiate that recall in cases where it deems appropriate. On a two-thirds vote of the board would be authorized to refer the recall to the members of a region. And upon making that decision to refer the question, members in a region would be given notice. If the affected governor does not resign within 10 days, then there would be a balloting process. And a recall, of course, would require a majority of votes cast. Again, this amendment enhances the bar's ability to govern and carry out its responsibilities in managing the affairs of the bar. It gives the board a mechanism to seek membership recall of a board member who, in the estimation of the board, is not acting in the best interest of the bar. The third change has to do with the State Lawyers Assistance Committee. As you may know, the State Lawyers Assistance Committee exists by statute to investigate and resolve complaints or referrals about lawyers whose conduct may impair their ability to practice law. Typically, the committee gets a referral about a lawyer and will evaluate the situation, try to determine what the problem is, and then develop a remedial program for the lawyer to resolve that problem. These are all, of course, non-disciplinary matters. These are usually lawyers with drug and alcohol and sometimes mental health problems. One of the virtues of the program, of the State Lawyers Assistance Program, is that it has statutory confidentiality, which is an enhancement for getting lawyers to participate in the process. The Board of Governors would like to expand the role of the State Lawyers Assistance Committee to allow it to serve as monitor and supervisor in disciplinary probation and other cases where lawyers have been conditionally admitted to practice. In those cases, the monitor or supervisor needs to be able to report to the bar if there's a breach of the diversion or probation agreement. And the board is concerned that the language of the statute with its confidentiality does not allow for any alternate process. So what we're proposing in Senate Bill 272 is really to create a two-track system so that in cases where SLAC is the State Lawyers Assistance Committee is operating as a diversion monitor or a probation monitor, there would not be that statutory confidentiality. And also, as counsel mentioned, we're deleting the reference in the statute to the local lawyers' assistance committees because we don't use them and they're kind of not necessary. And the final change is to the Client Security Fund. Again, as the members of the committee may know, this is a fund that the board created in 1967 to reimburse clients whose lawyers steal their money. Currently, the statute limits reimbursement to clients whose lawyers maintain an office in Oregon, and we've had a few situations where we had lawyers who were licensed in Oregon and in another state and don't maintain an office in Oregon, and we couldn't pay those claims because they didn't maintain an office here, even though they were licensed bar members. So we want to change that language to eliminate the need for the lawyers to maintain an office, but to require that they be engaged in that the loss be related to their practice of law in Oregon so that there's a sufficient nexus for Oregon to pay those claims. And we believe this change is necessary to permit the Client Security Fund to carry out its mission of reimbursing clients of defalcating lawyers. I would urge you to move this bill to the full committee with a due pass recommendation, and I thank you for the opportunity to testify today, and I'm happy to answer any questions anybody may have.
Fine. We'll see if the committee wants to do that. Do you have questions for the witness committee? Yes, Representative McPherson does.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Stevens, this is a little bit off topic, but I'm curious about this. We have a couple of other bills that one still pending in the committee and one that was moved out of the House relating to the licensing of professionals just generally, and it was brought forward. These are proposals that originated with the administrative law section of the bar, and they were generally being promoted by that section of the bar but resisted by licensing boards. And it just occurred to me that the Oregon State Bar itself is a licensing agency, and I'm curious about whether you're part of the bar, that is, the bar in its licensing capacity, which some of these proposals at least touch on, what your view is of those other proposals related to the sort of procedural rights of licensees vis-a-vis the licensing function of the bar. Is that an issue that you have any knowledge of or perspectives on?
No particular knowledge of the other bills that are pending, and I guess I would point out, Representative McPherson, that it's actually the Supreme Court that issues the licenses. We do have the administrative function for the Board of Bar Examiners is handled through the bar, but it's really the Supreme Court that makes those decisions, and everything we do is by delegation. But so it's a little bit different, I think, than some of the other licensing bodies. But no, I actually am not aware of the other legislation, okay. And it would be I'd be speaking out of turn if I told you what I thought without knowing
anything. Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative. Further questions from the committee? Seeing none, thank you again for your testimony.
Thank you all.
Anyone else wishing to testify on Senate Bill 272A? Seeing none, then I will close the public hearing on that House bill, and we'll hold that in abeyance until I guess we have a quorum at this point. And I will open a work session on House Bill 272A and look for a motion on that bill. The chair will move that Senate Bill 272A be forwarded to the full committee with a due pass recommendation. Is there a discussion on the motion? Seeing none, the clerk may call the roll.
Representative Lawrence?
Aye.
Representative
Gerard? Aye.
Representative Burke excused. Chair Ackerman?
Aye. Senate Bill 272A is forwarded to the full committee with a due pass recommendation, and the work session on that bill is concluded. We'll go back and open a work session on the first bill we heard this morning, House Bill 2566. And for those of you that weren't here, this incorporates the mediation process within the juvenile court system, and Representative Anderson and Representative from, I think, DHS testified favorably for the bill. Are there any motions on House Bill 2566? Representative Flores, you're...
just lurching in there, and we would be adopting the Dash 1 amendments, is that correct?
Do we need the Dash 1s first, Council?
We do.
Okay. The chair will move that the Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 2566 be adopted. Is there discussion on the motion? Seeing none, that's allowed.
Mr. Chair, I would move House Bill 2566 to the full committee with a due pass as amended recommendation.
Representative Flores moves that House Bill 2566 as amended be forwarded to the full committee with a due pass recommendation. Is there a discussion on the motion? Hearing none, the clerk may call the roll.
Representative Flores?
Aye.
Representative Gerard?
Aye.
Representative Burke excused. Chair Ackerman?
Aye. House Bill 2566, as amended, is forwarded to the full committee with a due pass recommendation. Close the work session on that bill. I think we're down to we're going to Senate bills now, and that's good news. Senate Bill 275A. What I'm going to do, since 275A and 276 are of the same subject matter, and I believe 276 is included within 275, that's what I understand, I'll open a public hearing on both of those measures, 275A and 276. And Council, explain the bills to us, please.
Chair Ackerman, members of the committee, thank you. Senate Bill 275A is the bill that would adopt the version of the Uniform Trust Code and incorporate much of the existing Oregon statutes such that there are on trust and trust administration. The measure was developed by a work group of legal experts on this topic that have been meeting since 2002. The measure generally follows the Uniform Trust Code, however, it modifies a number of provisions to conform to existing Oregon law. The overriding principles throughout this version of the UTC are that a trustee must act in good faith and can be consistent with the intent of the settlor, and that the terms of the trust must be for the benefit of the beneficiary. The major provisions that are included in this Uniform Act include the governing law, the principal place of administration, methods of providing notice to interested parties, appointment of special representatives, methods of creating trust, and the creation and administration of charitable trust, pet trust, spendthrift trusts, and revocable trusts. There is a Dash 3 amendment that I was just provided this morning that should be in your packet, and the Dash 3 is a change to the section that deals with pet trusts, and I believe, although I've not been able to compare it to the original language of 275A, I believe it is just a minor clarification of the original section of the bill, which is Section 28. The measure passed the Senate, by the way, 27-2, with one excluded. And Chair Ackerman correctly pointed out that Senate Bill 276 is wholly included in Senate Bill 275. And 276 is the bill that deals with the severance of trusts. That bill, and again, the contents of 276 are wholly included in 275, but what 276 does is It allows trustees to sever trusts unless the terms of the trust itself expressly prohibit that. And what this is intended to do is allow the individuals to take into account different tax characteristics of each trust when they make administration decisions. It also passed the Senate 26-1 with 3 excused.
Thank you, Counsel. If I follow this, we would have to do the dash threes on Senate Bill 275.
That is correct.
That trust variation. Okay. I have 5 or 6 witnesses all in favor of the proposition, so that's good news. I have people at the table already, so introduce yourselves and testify.
Chair Ackerman, members of the subcommittee, my name is Jennifer Todd. I've been an Oregon attorney since 1983, practicing generally in the areas of wills, trusts, and probate. From 1994 to 2000, I was a pro tem probate judge in Marion County. I was in private practice from 2000 to 2004, and I've been on the faculty at the Willamette University College of Law since 2003. I am a member of the study committee that is bringing Senate Bill 275 before you today. I would like to speak first about why it is important to enact Senate Bill 275, the Oregon Uniform Trust Code. During the past 20 years, trusts have become an increasingly useful and important estate planning tool. Unfortunately, in Oregon, it is very difficult to determine exactly what law applies to trusts. The trust code will provide, for the first time, a comprehensive and easily accessible source for determining Oregon trust law. Currently, Oregon has relatively few statutes dealing with trusts. In recent years, we have codified several aspects of trust law. We have the Prudent Investor Act. We also have statutes dealing with the modification of trust, pet trust, and using a certification of trust. These and other Oregon statutes are useful, but having a single trust code that codifies Oregon trust law in one place has many benefits. Without the trust code, trust law in Oregon is basically American common law. This is law that judges and appeals court make when they decide cases. Few Oregon cases on trust exist, however, so we must look to cases from other states or to the restatement of the law of trust, which is a national guide to trust law. Although the restatement is a good source for finding general common law rules, having a source that clearly reflects the Oregon approach would be better. Next, I would like to explain briefly how the proposed Oregon Uniform Trust Code was developed, because the process helps explain why the Oregon State Bar and the Oregon Bankers Association support its adoption. Several years ago, the National Conference of Commissioners on Uniform State Laws began developing a uniform law on the subject of trusts. The goal was to develop a uniform law that any state could study, adapt to fit the state's own needs and preferences, and then enact. The commissioners believed that codifying trust law would benefit everyone who deals with trusts, the people who set them up, the trustees who administer them, the beneficiaries who receive distributions, and the advisors of all of these people. Trusts today often involve more than one state, and the commissioners thought that having a generally uniform body of trust law would allow greater efficiency in dealing with trusts that cross state lines. This project resulted in the creation of the Uniform Trust Code in the year 2000. In 2002, several Oregon professionals with an interest in trust law began studying the Uniform Trust Code to see whether enactment of a trust code in Oregon would be beneficial. We formed a committee, co-chaired by Professor Valerie Vollmer of the Willamette University College of Law and Professor Susan Gary of the University of Oregon School of Law. The study committee included lawyers and bankers from around the state with various areas of interest and backgrounds. Members of the study committee included representatives of 3 sections of the Oregon State Bar, the Estate Planning and Administration section, the Elder Law section, and the Taxation section, as well as current and former probate judges and representatives of the Oregon Bankers Association. The committee worked on this project for over 2 years. The study committee solicited the participation of every group that might have an interest in Oregon trust law, including all other sections of the Oregon State Bar and the Oregon Attorney General's Office. Subcommittees that studied specific aspects of the Uniform Trust Code included a wide range of individuals beyond the members of the study committee itself. Thoughtful and critical input from all of these people has produced proposed legislation that will be useful for everyone in the state of Oregon. As the study committee reviewed the Uniform Trust Code and considered how the Uniform Act should be modified in an Oregon Trust Code, we were guided by 2 basic principles. First, we chose generally to follow the existing law in Oregon, making only changes that would improve Oregon law and were non-controversial. If conflicting views surfaced about whether Oregon law should be changed, the committee chose not to change current law, but rather to defer any discussion of possible change until after adoption of a trust code. The second basic principle that guided the study committee was a preference to follow the provisions of the Uniform Trust Code whenever possible. Oregon follows the common law of trusts, and much of the Uniform Trust Code simply codifies basic trust rules. We believed that having a relatively uniform body of trust law across the United States would be of great benefit, so that adopting uniform rules and language when possible made sense. The Oregon Uniform Trust Code, then, is based on the Uniform Act, but a number of the provisions of that act have been modified to reflect current Oregon law. In addition to my own testimony, I am presenting written testimony from several other supporters of the Oregon Uniform Trust Code. This testimony describes more specifically some of the benefits of the Oregon Trust Code that it offers to the people of Oregon. Two of these witnesses are current Oregon judges, Marion County Circuit Court Judge Claudia M. Burton and Washington County Circuit Court Judge Pro Tem Rita Batts Cobb, both of whom are very experienced in probate matters. Judge Burton and Judge Cobb support the Oregon Uniform Trust Code because it will clarify trust law in Oregon, establish clear procedures to address trust issues, and reduce the need for court intervention in trust matters. Judge Cobb served on our study committee. I am also presenting written testimony from three lawyers who are in private practice, Ron Bailey of Portland, Alan Brown of Newburgh, and Tim O'Rourke of Pendleton. Respectively, they represent three sections of the Oregon State Bar, the Estate Planning and Administration Section, the Elder Law Section, and the Taxation Section, all of which support the adoption of the Oregon Uniform Trust Code. And all three of these witnesses also served on our study committee. I can assure you that the study committee has done a thorough job of considering all aspects of the original Uniform Trust Code and has adapted it to reflect current Oregon law and practices. If enacted, the most important improvements the Oregon Uniform Trust Code will make are to codify existing trust law and to provide Oregonians with accessible rules for administering trusts. I urge the Judiciary Committee to move this bill to the full House with a due pass recommendation. Thank you for the opportunity to testify before you today, and I would be happy to answer any questions.
Fine. Thank you for your testimony. I think we'll take the second witness and then ask questions. Okay. May proceed.
Wonderful. Thank you. Chair Ackerman, members of the subcommittee, my name is Susan Gary. As you've heard, I was the co-chair of the study committee that worked on the Uniform Trust Code in Oregon. I've been a lawyer since 1981. My law practice, when I was in practice, was in the area of estate planning, working with wills and trusts. I have been a member of the faculty of the University of Oregon School of Law since 1992. I am an active member of the Estate Planning Section of the Oregon Bar, and I'm currently serving on the Executive Committee of the Estate Planning Section of the Bar. You have heard from Ms. Todd about the scope of the Trust Code and a little bit about the process by which we developed the bill that you have before you. I want to talk a little more specifically about what the Trust Code does and a little bit more about our process. I think it is first important to note that the trust code is default law. The person who creates a trust can control almost all aspects of the trust about how it will be operated, how it will be governed. There are some basic rules of trust law that will apply and can't be changed by the person who creates a trust. For example, the trustee must always act in good faith. The court can always intervene in the interests of justice, and there are a few other fiduciary principles that apply. But for the most part, trust law is default law, and the documents that created the trust provide the specifics for the trust. What the Uniform Trust Law Trust Code does is to provide the specifics if the documents that were used to create the trust did not. They provide the kind of backup rules, if you will, for management of the trust, and we believe it's important and useful to have those backup rules all located in one place. The Trust Code provides these rules with respect to a number of particular things. The Trust Code discusses who can represent a beneficiary in connection with the trust, if the beneficiary is a minor, is incompetent, or maybe is not yet born. The Trust Code also spells out the methods for creating a trust, for modifying a trust, and for terminating a trust. The trust code explains the rights of creditors against the settlor, the person who created the trust, or the beneficiary of a trust. The trust code sets forth the duties, responsibilities, and rights of the trustee of the trust and provides a list of powers that the trustee will have. And the trust code provides the scope of the beneficiary's rights in the trust to seek a remedy if the trustee is suspected of violating some of the trustee's duties under the trust. These are all rules that currently exist under the common law, and in Oregon, some of these rules have been codified already in the statute. The trust code puts all of the rules in one place and will make it much easier for trustees, beneficiaries, and their counsel to find those rules and to make appropriate decisions about trusts. The approach of the study committee, as you've heard, was to codify existing current law, Oregon law, making changes to current Oregon law only to the extent we thought the Uniform Act improved Oregon law, but in those cases only where the changes were not controversial. We on the study committee thought that this bill was not the place to tackle big policy issues and concluded that we should leave those for another day when the legislature could focus more specifically on those policy issues. So in some respects, we have modified the uniform version of the trust code to make the Oregon trust code one that does not change Oregon law in ways that will be controversial. There were two particular provisions I want to call to your attention that have had that have raised some controversy in other states. We learned from what happened in other states, and we modified the trust code so that the impact on current Oregon law of these particular issues would be minimal. One of these two issues involves the rights of former spouses and children who are owed support by a parent, and whether those former spouses and children can reach assets in a trust that was created by a third party, usually the parent of the person who owes the duty of support, or perhaps a grandparent. Most trusts today contain a spendthrift provision which protects trust assets from creditors of a beneficiary, and the question that has surfaced is whether these particular creditors, former spouses and children owed support, should be able to reach assets in a trust that are subject to the discretion of the trustee. The study committee consulted with many interested groups, discussed this provision a lot, and concluded that the best approach for the trust code was to leave the development and determination of the law in this area to the courts or to the legislature at some future date. And it is important to note that the study committee is not making a policy statement one way or the other. This particular issue is left, again, to the courts or to the legislature. The second issue that generated controversy in other states involved the trustee's duty to provide information to beneficiaries of a trust. Current Oregon law requires a trustee to respond to requests for information from a beneficiary, but may not require the trustee to provide information in the absence of a request. And I say may not. I looked at the law as carefully as I could and wasn't even sure about where the edges of that duty were. One of the nice things now about having the trust code is we have a much clearer sense of what the law is. It's important for a beneficiary to know enough about the trust to be able to keep an eye on the trustee and to enforce the trust if the trustee perhaps is not doing what the trustee should be doing. But we thought that the Uniform Trust Code created a duty to inform beneficiaries that was more extensive than was appropriate, and we cut back that duty. The Oregon Trust Code that you have before you in bill form requires that the trustee must send annual countings to the current beneficiaries, the beneficiaries who have current interests in the trust. And this provision does add an affirmative duty that the trustee probably does not have under current law. But, again, much of this code is default law, and the settlor can choose to modify this provision as long as someone has the right to receive information about the trust. The concern was that a trust may be created for a wayward child who perhaps would be better served not knowing all the details about the trust. And as long as the settlor provides that information can be provided to someone else, some other trusted person who can keep an eye on the trust, that will be sufficient. Other than these two provisions, and only one of these actually changes current law, The trust code changes Oregon law in only minimal ways. Our written testimony in support of this bill includes three additional documents, all contained in a single volume, that provide additional explanation. One document provides a brief description of the key changes this bill makes to existing law. A longer document provides information about all of the provisions of Senate Bill 275. And the official comments to the Oregon Uniform Trust Code are of particular use in providing background and describing to a greater degree the meaning of some of the provisions. The Oregon Uniform Trust Code will serve the people of Oregon well by providing clear answers to basic questions about the role of the person who creates a trust, the rights of beneficiaries in the trust, and the duties and rights of trustees of trust. The Oregon Uniform Trust Code does not deal with every nuance of trust law, and that role will remain with the courts. But by providing clear guidelines to the trustees, beneficiaries, and their lawyers, the Oregon Uniform Trust Code will make understanding trust law in Oregon much easier. Speaking on behalf of the study committee, I urge this subcommittee to move this bill to the full committee with the due pass recommendation. I also urge approval of the -3 amendments, which the study committee has reviewed and approves. And now I would also be happy to answer questions.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Do we have questions from the committee? Yes, Representative McPherson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Professor Gary, I just wanted to focus on the -3 amendments. It looks to me like the change being made is to delete some language that's in the main bill, which is refers to how property of the trust is to be applied, and it deletes the phrase, except to the extent the court determines that the value of the trust property exceeds the amount required for the intended use. And I wonder if you could just comment on that change and what's going on with that proposal.
Certainly, I'd be happy to, and I believe there may be somebody else here testifying about that as well. The concern with the provision as drafted in the Uniform Act was that provision that you just read that will be deleted would allow the court on its own motion to change a trust that a settlor had created with a particular intent in mind, reducing the amount that was held in the trust for beneficiaries, in this case for animals. This provision is part of the section of the trust of the code that deals with pet trusts. And the concern is that a trust created for a pet by the pet's owner, presumably, has to follow certain rules in order to be valid as a trust. Those rules are spelled out in the code. And as long as the person who creates a trust follows those rules, the concern is that the person should be able to put aside as much money or property as that person wishes on behalf of the pet. There are provisions in the code that require termination. And that guide the termination of the trust, so the trust cannot be held in perpetuity. But that's the purpose behind that deletion.
Does that answer your question?
I think it does. let me follow up. I mean,
could you repeat the question again?
it looks to me as though what happens is it's like a reversion. To the extent that the property exceeds the use, and in this case, as you, I hadn't realized this is all part of the pet trust
right.
section of the bill, but to the extent that it exceeds the intended use, then it reverts, in effect, to the settlor's successors in interest. So rather than having this reference that doesn't indicate what the court does with it if they determine the value exceeds the amount required for the intended use, so it's simply a reversion clause, it looks like to me, et cetera.
That's correct, and the concern and the reason for the deletion is that the thought is that the settlor, the person creating the trust, should be the one to decide when the trust terminates or when that portion of the trust terminates, and also to decide how much is appropriate for the pet, rather than having a court step in and say, well, we don't think the pet really needs this much property. It's a question of who gets to make that decision.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Further questions? Yes, Representative Flores.
Thank you. Either one of you. Section 26 deals with the creation and trust induced by fraud, duress, or undue influence. Is that a new section of the trust code?
No, it's not. Trust law in general, it has not been codified, but it does exist in the common law. And for Oregon lawyers, the source of the common law, if we don't have cases, which in Oregon we have very few cases, means that lawyers look to the restatement of trust, which sets out rules about how trusts are operated. And there is in the restatement, there are provisions that say that a trust that's created under undue influence or fraud or duress will be or can be determined to be an invalid trust. And that rule already exists. We don't have a lot of case law in this state, but we do have case law from other states that we can look to for that rule. So it's not a new rule. It's just a codification of the common law.
Follow up.
You may.
Then who, I asked because I've had a couple of constituents actually that have dealt with the creation of trusts that obviously were made under fraud and duress, and they were never able to reach the whole issue. So who is the arbiter then of the undue influence and duress?
It is a matter that's left up to the court, and I might defer to Ms. Todd since she was a probate judge. Let me just say that I do think it is harder to reach a trust on these grounds than it is a will, because the will is already in court. With a trust, it's necessary for someone to bring the trust into court. And having said that, I'll turn it over to our court expert.
Did you have any more specific question about that, or just want more about the process?
A little bit about the process.
Okay, well, the way that trusts come before the court, in a probate, you have a will that's admitted to probate, that's automatically a court proceeding. The way that a trust comes before the court is someone files a petition with the court to do something that the statute authorizes that person to ask the court to do. So if you have this statute that clearly states that fraudulent trusts can be dealt with, then the court clearly has the authority to do that, and somebody can file a petition using that provision as a basis for getting before the court. And then the court would apply general principles of fraud and just whatever is in maybe the restatement of the law of trust in deciding whether that was a fraudulent inducement to create the trust or whatever. And then the court would decide whatever remedies the person was entitled to, whether it would be return of the property or damages if the fraudulent person had assets.
Follow up.
You may.
And then additional question as well.
Okay.
And then the person who is suspicious that it was a fraudulently made trust, they would bring that under a separate civil proceeding and or request?
Well, that's a good question. Do you know the answer to that?
Well, by separate, it's we're outside of probate because there is no will,
right.
So it would be a case that would be started on its own, which I think is the answer to your question. They would bring it as a separate proceeding by filing the petition indicating that there was a suspicion of fraud. The part of the problem there is determining whether the person bringing the petition has standing to bring that petition. They would be the person who would benefit if the trust were ruled invalid due to fraud. If they were in that situation, they would have standing to bring the petition. But sometimes that's a question that can block someone if it's not clear that they would be the person then to take the property if the trust were invalid.
Thank you. And for my question, Mr. Chair.
All right, you're informed. Thank you.
In regard to the duty to provide annual reports, mm-hmm. Now, that is not current practice, is that correct?
That's correct.
And then the person who has made the trust, the trustor,
right.
Would have to engage, or the trustee would have to engage an attorney to provide the annual accountings, is that correct?
Not necessarily an attorney. The accountings and the reports could be provided by the trustee himself, herself, or itself, depending on who the trustee is, if they had that ability. The trustee has always had a duty to keep adequate records, and so the duty to keep the records has always existed under the law, and the duty to respond to requests for information has always existed. So a trustee would typically need to file a tax return, for example, for the trust, and would have
a record of the income, the receipts, the disbursements that were made under the trust, and does have a duty under current law to have that information available. The trust code doesn't specify the form that the information has to be provided to the beneficiary, so if that information is already in a form that's clear enough for the beneficiary, that information could be given to the beneficiary without additional legal counsel, certainly.
Follow-up to that.
May?
I'm wondering how many trustors are going to be happy about having to have this information provided on an annual basis to their intended down-the-road recipients.
That was the issue that we spent a lot of time discussing, and that has been an issue that has been some concern. And for that reason, we did restrict the this duty under the Oregon version. It's much more restrictive than under the Uniform Trust Code. We restricted it in a couple of ways. First is the way that I mentioned, that the information has to be provided to somebody, but it doesn't have to be the beneficiary of the trust. If there's a reason to keep the information secret from the trustor can decide to do that by naming somebody else. In addition, one of the concerns that we have is that we use a lot of revocable trusts in Oregon and elsewhere around the country. A trust created, I could create a trust for myself and perhaps for my spouse after I die. And the concern was that as long as I'm alive, as long as my spouse is alive, we might not want the kids to know what's in that trust. And so that provision is in the trust code also. For revocable trusts, the settlor, the trustor, can decide to limit this information to the trustor, myself, and the trustor's spouse as long as the spouse is alive. And if the spouse is the mother or father of the children, if they're children from separate marriages, it gets a little more complicated. The reason that we didn't allow the trustor to provide that information need not be given to anyone is a concern about being able to enforce the trust. If no one has information about the trust and the trustor may no longer be alive, someone needs to be able to keep an eye on the trustee. And so we were trying to balance those two concerns, one of giving the information to someone so someone can keep an eye on the trustee and the trustee doesn't run off with the money, but on the other hand, not requiring so much, not requiring that the information be given to so many people that that created a problem, or that this duty to report becomes so onerous that it became too difficult for the trustors. So we worked very hard to try to balance those two provisions. We were helped in part by the fact that other states have looked at this uniform product already, and the District of Columbia came up with some of the provisions that we then used, particularly the provision that allows us to give information to someone other than the beneficiary, kind of substitute person that we took from another state. So we were actually helped in our process by not being the first one to look at this code and getting ideas from the way other states had addressed this very issue.
Mr. Chair, I could...
Well, the follow-up, but a comment in that regard, but the substitute person was in the regard you had, in the context of having a wayward child or beneficiary. So that, but that substitute recipient of the information was not necessarily for someone who is not a wayward child.
Oh, it can be. There's no restriction on when you use that. Our reason for providing that provision was the concern about the wayward child. It could be under any circumstance. There's no restriction on when that substitute person could be used by the trustor in that situation.
Last follow-up?
Yes.
Thank you. I guess when you say annual reporting, it throws me in the context of in regard to an estate proceeding where you have beginning balances and all your assets listed and values as of, and they're going on and so on and so on. Now, you did indicate earlier that there was no specific format set forth, and it could be maybe just a letter, but nonetheless, that could be quite an extensive document. Are you setting forth any format for an annual accounting?
I think part of what will happen if this is adopted is a lot of education of the lawyers who will be helping their clients, but also of the public to the extent that we can reach that, about issues like this. I think the sense is that that information should already exist. A trustee who takes on the responsibility of being a trustee should be keeping track of the annual receipts and disbursements. So the information should exist already. What hasn't existed is an affirmative duty to provide that to the beneficiaries. So I don't think we're adding too much, but your point is well taken. I think figuring out how to do that in a way that is acceptable to the beneficiaries, and then if the beneficiary raises a question to a court, will be important. And so part of our mission will be to provide as much education about what would be appropriate as possible.
Well, and one thing to add to that is that under current law, a beneficiary can go to the court and request an accounting that goes back to whenever the last accounting happened. And so it's almost a benefit to require the trustee to keep current records and to provide that information to the beneficiaries. And did the provision providing protection to the trustee, did that get carried forward if the accounting is provided within this? So there's also a provision that if the trustee provides this accounting and a certain length of time passes and the beneficiary hasn't objected, then the trustee is protected that, yes, everything that was in that accounting is okay, perhaps with an exception if there were some sort of fraud or misrepresentation.
Right.
So there's some protection provided to the trustee. It's currently allowed by law only at the request of the beneficiary.
Okay, one last follow-up.
All right.
My final answer.
You get 3 credit hours for this from a law school of your choice.
Is it a common practice for beneficiaries to request an accounting from a trustee of trusts that are created?
Well, I can answer that from the court's point of view, and normally what happens is the beneficiary would have to file a petition with the court. The beneficiary could request one informally, and if the trustee refused to provide one, the beneficiary would have to go to court, file a petition, ask that the court order the trustee to provide an annual accounting, which, you know, that's not very helpful for the beneficiary to have to go to court to get an accounting about something that they have an interest in.
And I think, if I may, in addition, the corporate trustees, bank trustees, do provide that information because they want the protection of having provided that information to their beneficiaries. I think I don't have much of a sense or as much of a sense of the relationship between individual, just people like you and I who are acting as trustees and the beneficiaries. My guess is some of the trustees provide the information already, even though they're not required to do that, and some don't. Some beneficiaries are distressed and want to find out what's going on and request that information, and some are happy as long as they get their check. So it's probably all over the place in terms of how people operate.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Are there further questions from the committee? If not, we'll excuse you and call up the next panel. I just want to give the folks out here a reality check. I have 4 more witnesses on this bill. I have 5 more bills to get through in probably a little bit more than an hour when we go into session at 11 o'clock. So particularly on this bill, since this has been well discussed, if you could summarize your testimony, that would really help us move this on. The more we delay, the longer time it's going to take us to get the full committee and under the floor with bills which obviously have merit. So I'll call the next panel. Chris Klein, looks like Ken Sherman, Tim Martinez. I might also say that I have supporting letters in the file from AARP, several circuit court judges, and several practitioners. I have no opposition at this point, so let's see what happens.
Chair Ackerman, members of the committee, my name is Chris Klein. I'm the current chair of the Executive Committee of the Oregon State Bar's Estate Planning Section, and I will be very brief. First, I'd like to let the committee know that the section, which is the formal sponsor of the bill, is in complete support of the bill and urges it that it be passed with a due pass recommendation. To respond to Representative Flory's questions about accountings, there's actually less here than meets the eye, in the sense that this really applies primarily to irrevocable trusts after the person who created the trust has died, and best practices has always been to provide these accountings, and you wind up as a trustee getting into a bit of a give and take with a given beneficiary about how that looks. So a lot of this sort of works itself out. So just speaking from a practical perspective, the issue doesn't really change the situation in Oregon much with respect to accountings. With respect to the -3 amendment, this amendment would simply take the Uniform Trust Code back to the statute that the section advanced and that was enacted in 2003, which allowed for trusts to be created for the benefit of pets. The Uniform Trust Code included inadvertently a provision that allowed judges to take money essentially out of the trust and send it somewhere else. And so the reason for the amendment is simply to restore the bill that we submitted and that was enacted back in 2003. And then finally, I'm also the only speaker on Senate Bill 276. As was already mentioned, that bill is completely included inside 275. It's an extremely important but not very controversial bill, so I don't want to take it up at the moment, but since there's no opposition, I think we're okay. And I'll simply allow questions on 276 rather than say anything further. Thank you.
It's yours to lose, as we say. Next witness.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, Tim Martinez here on behalf of the Oregon Bankers Association. The prior panel did a wonderful job explaining the bill. I do have one of my own legal experts, as Mr. O'Leary mentioned, sitting to the right of me on the other side of Mr. Klein, Ken Sherman, Jr., who has some very, very brief remarks.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Ken Sherman, counsel for the OBA. I served along with Alan Bennett, Senior Trust Officer at Pioneer Trust Bank here in Salem for the last 2.5 years on the study group that helped to bring this bill to you. The OBA strongly supports this measure, feels that it will build a solid foundation for the drafting and administration of trusts here in Oregon, and I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Other questions from the committee? I see none. Thank you very much for your participation this morning. Last witness, I believe, is Randy Covey. Let's come forward, please. I think this is on the Dash 3 amendments, if I'm correct.
Chair Ackerman, members of the committee, thank you for your time, and I will also be brief. Representative McPherson, I think I may be able to answer some questions you have about specifically about the pet trust section. But I am here. My name is Randy Covey. I'm a field operations supervisor for the Oregon Humane Society, probably uniquely qualified to answer questions about pets and the costs of providing for them. I'm testifying today in support of Senate Bill 275 and the Dash A3 amendments. These simply recognize that people that create trusts, it is their money and it is their pets. They set a trust aside to provide for the pets for the pets' remaining life, and it recognizes that the court may not be able to determine what those costs may be, and it does provide for an appropriate dispersal of the funds after the pet has passed on. So again, I urge your support of Senate Bill 275-A3 amendments, and that you send it forward.
Thank you for your testimony. Are there questions of this witness? Good job. No questions. Thank you very much for your participation. Are there further witnesses on Senate Bill 275A? Seeing none, I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 275A. And looks like we do have a quorum. I will open a work session on Senate Bill 275A. Is there a motion, Representative Garrard?
Mr. Chair, I would move the Dash 3 amendments into Senate Bill 275A.
Representative Garrard moves the Dash 3 amendments into Senate Bill 275. Is there any discussion or objection? If not, that's allowed. Motion on the bill? Yes, Representative Garrard.
Mr. Chair, I would move Senate Bill 275A as amended to the full committee with a do-pass recommendation.
Representative Garrard moves Senate Bill 275A as amended to the full committee with a do-pass recommendation. Is there any discussion on the motion? Seeing none, the clerk may call the roll.
Representative Flores?
Aye.
Representative Garrard?
Aye.
Representative Flores, excused. Chair
Ackerman? Aye. Senate Bill 275A is forwarded to the full committee with a due pass recommendation. I will close the work session on Senate Bill 275A, and I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 276. And with that, we'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 277. Counsel, you want to tell us about this bill?
Thank you, Chair Ackerman, members of the committee. Senate Bill 277 also has to do with trusts. It comes to us from the Oregon State Bar Estate Planning section. And what this bill does is clarify something that was made unclear as a result of the 2003 legislature. This has to do with trusts for minors. And the prior law permitted the delay of the transfer of the trust property until the beneficiary turned 21. In 2003, the legislature extended the delay until the beneficiary turns 25. However, there were other provisions of the Trust Act as it existed at the time and as it existed now that went unchanged, and one was the definition of the term minor. Minor is defined as a person under 21. So the unclarity here exists between the definition of minor as someone who turns 20, who is under 21, and the law from 2003 that permitted the delay of the transfer of the trust property until an individual turns 25. What this measure does is corrects that unclarity by substituting the word beneficiary for the word minor where appropriate throughout the existing statutes. And this makes clear that the trust property may be delayed until the beneficiary reaches age 25. The measure passed the Senate 24-1 with 4 excused.
Fine. Thank you, Counsel. I have one witness, Mr. Chris Klein, please.
Chair Ackerman, members of the committee, for the record, I'm still Chris Klein, and I'm the chair of the Oregon State Bar's Executive Committee on Estate Planning. I'd like to make one minor clarification to Council's comments. This actually deals with situations where there is not a trust. The Uniform Transfers to Minors Act allows a person to give property to a minor without the complications of creating a trust. For example, your will might leave $10,000 to your grandchild, and while that's a significant amount of money, it's not enough necessarily to put it into a formal trust that requires a separate tax return to be filed. What the Uniform Transfers to Minors Act allows a person to do is to give the property to someone else as a custodian, and it does not require some of the formal compliance aspects of a trust, particularly the filing of a separate tax return. The custodian does still have fiduciary obligations to the minor and must comply, you know, with proper investment procedure and so forth. So you have all the fiduciary standards there with a little less of the formality. In 2003, the section supported and the law was enacted allowing the extension of the time that the Uniform Transfers to Minors Act account could last until age 25. Experience was that age 21 didn't really quite seem to be old enough given the amount of time it takes essentially for minors to get through college. And 25 seemed like a more appropriate age. The problem with the bill as enacted in 03 was that it still referred to minors, and this raised the question, well, what if you wanted to give property into one of these custodial accounts for someone who was 22? If they were not a minor, then perhaps you couldn't establish the account. And all this bill does is clarify that you can create the account for any person who is under the age of 25.
Thank you for your testimony. Are there questions from the committee? All right, seeing none, thank you.
Thank you.
Any further witnesses on Senate Bill 277? With that, I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 277. And open a work session on Senate Bill 277. Do we have a motion?
Mr. Chair, I'll move Senate Bill 277 to the full committee with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Flores moves that Senate Bill 277 be forwarded to the full committee with a due pass recommendation. Is there a discussion? Objection? Clerk, may call the roll.
Representative Flores?
Aye.
Representative Girard?
Aye.
Representative Woods, excused. Chair
Ackerman? Aye. Senate Bill 277 is forwarded to the full committee with a due pass recommendation, and the work session on that bill is closed. We'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 278A and ask counsel to explain the bill.
Thank you, Chair Ackerman, members of the committee. Senate Bill 278 comes to us from the Oregon State Bar Health Law Section, and this measure concerns the definition of who may act as a personal representative of a deceased person for purposes of access to protected health information records under HIPAA, the Health Insurance Portability and Accountability Act. The current law is that only individuals who are appointed by the court are deemed to be personal representatives of a decedent for purposes of disclosure of information under HIPAA. And this measure would create a prioritized list of persons to whom such information could be disclosed if there were no court-appointed representative, or if a court-appointed representative had been appointed in the past but has subsequently been discharged. The prioritized list goes as follows. A person appointed as guardian is number one. The decedent's spouse is number two. Then another adult designated in writing by the other person on the list, if no one objects, is number three. The majority of the adult children of the decedent who can be located are number four. Number five, either parent of the decedent or a person acting in loco parentis. Number six is the majority of the adult siblings of the decedent who can be located. And finally, any adult relative or friend, if none of the other categories can be filled.
Thank you. We have a witness. Good morning. Can you state your name for the record, please?
Yes, my name is Kelly Hagan. I'm an attorney in Portland. I'm appearing here on behalf of the Health Law Section of the Oregon State Bar. I've submitted written testimony, one-page summary of the situation created by HIPAA and Oregon state law. I think I can boil it down a little further than that. counsel for the committee has done a good job describing the problem, which is that HIPAA's protection of protected health information continues after the death of the patient. And since the patient cannot consent to the disclosure of that information to someone else, and there is no personal representative under state law available, healthcare providers are unable to disclose information for very legitimate purposes to people who need it. And so what this bill does is borrow the list that was created in our advanced directive statute for those persons who can make essentially life and death decisions for folks unable to make their own decisions, and allows healthcare providers to look to those individuals for a decision about disclosure. I would comment that the one amendment made on the Senate side at our behest was done because the bill was not sufficiently clear that the list would become operative in circumstances where a personal representative had been appointed but then subsequently discharged, so that no existing personal representative would be able to make that decision about disclosure. I'd be happy to answer any questions from the committee.
Are there questions from the committee? Yes, Representative McPherson.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Hagan, just to understand where this is useful, would it be situations where maybe there's an inherited disease that has genetic characteristics, and so, say, descendants are trying to open the medical records of an ancestor to find out what the medical condition was? Help me out in understanding what the purpose is of this.
Mr. Chairman, Representative McPherson, that certainly would be one of the circumstances where you'd want to be able to get at information about an ancestor or someone, a blood relation. More typically, I think, probably is a situation where people are making application for proceeds from a life insurance policy. And there's been some question of maybe about the cause of death, and so the insurer will ask for medical information, and the surviving spouse or other beneficiary of the policy is frankly unable to get it under certain circumstances, that being there being no personal representative authorized disclosure.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Further questions from the committee?
Mr. Chair.
Yes. President Flores.
Thank you. Mr. Hagan, when is a surviving spouse precluded from obtaining the type of information that would be provided under HIPAA?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Flores, in any situation in which the spouse does not have standing as a personal representative to obtain disclosure. It's one of the myths, frankly, in healthcare that a spouse has ready access to the protected health information of their spouse. Under federal law, unless they're armed with a court order or an order appointing them as a personal representative, they simply do not have the right currently to obtain that information.
Thank you.
Question I have is, in this situation, I think there's a prioritized list of persons that would be able to obtain this information. How does the medical provider know where that person is on the hierarchy of priorities?
Chair, one clarification. It's not so much that this list of persons is authorized to receive the information as they are authorized to authorize its disclosure. Mm-hmm. It may be to a third party, point one. To your question, the prioritization of these individuals is something that healthcare providers are familiar with now. This list is in use for advanced directive purposes already. The overlay that HIPAA provides is what's called a verification requirement, such that if you're going to be disclosing information at the behest of someone supposedly authorized by someone on this list, it's going to be incumbent on the healthcare provider in the current law to verify the identity of the person making that decision.
That could be quite a job, it seems.
It is quite a job here, Mr. Chairman. However, you know, the standard use of these provisions is to, for example, require an order appointing you as guardian or a marriage license or some other legal document identifying you as a person under this list.
Thank you very much for your testimony and your answers. Are there further questions from the committee? Okay, seeing none, thank you. You're excused. Are there any other persons wanting to testify on Senate Bill 278? Yes, seeing none, then I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 278A and open the work session on Senate Bill 278A. Representative Girard.
Mr. Chair, I would move Senate Bill 278A to the full committee with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Girard moves that Senate Bill 278A be forwarded to the full committee with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Any objection? Clerk can call the roll.
Representative Flores?
Aye.
Representative Girard?
Aye.
Representative Worth excused. Chair Ackerman?
Aye. Senate Bill 275A is forwarded to the full committee. The due pass recommendation, and Representative Girard will be the carrier. With that, I'll close the work session on Senate Bill 278A. Open a public hearing on Senate Bill 284.
Chair Ackerman, members of the committee, Senate Bill 284 comes to you from the Procedure and Practice Committee of the Oregon State Bar. This measure would provide a suspension of all civil statutes of limitation for a period of 6 months after the death of the attorney for a person. If the attorney had agreed to represent the person in the action, the attorney-client relationship with the person is confirmed in writing with the attorney or by the attorney, and the attorney dies before the expiration of the time allowed by the statute for the commencement of the action. This measure passes Senate with a 25-5 vote.
Thank you, counsel. Looks like we produced a witness. You may state your name for the record, please.
Thank you, Chair Ackerman. My name is Michael Zussman. I am the chair of the Oregon State Bar Procedure and Practice Committee. Our committee is a balanced committee, both plaintiff and defense lawyers from around the state. Counsel's described the legislation very well. It is a narrow purpose, but nevertheless important bill to protect citizens of the state of Oregon in the rare instances where an attorney has agreed to take on a litigation matter and has done so in writing. The attorney then dies and the statute of limitation expires prior to the time another attorney has been able to review and pick up the file and discover that the matter in fact needs to be filed in a timely way. The primary purpose here, beneficiary, I would think, of this bill are going to be clients of solo practitioners or individuals in small law firms where file review is not automatically handed on to other members of a firm or other people in the office. So once again, narrow purpose, but nevertheless important. I urge your support for this bill. I'm prepared to answer any questions members of the committee might have.
Fine. Thank you. Are there questions from the committee? Yes, Representative Flores.
Thank you. Did this bill arise as a result of incidents having occurred where this happened, or is it something that we're preempting the possibility?
They did, in fact, occur. It's funny, when I testified on this on the other side, I had to answer I didn't know. It was subsequently explained to me that, in fact, one of your colleagues on the Senate side had some constituents who were affected by two or three specific instances.
Thank you. Further questions from the committee?
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative McPherson.
Just a brief question. Mr. Zussman, with respect to professional liability claims, there's something of a per se rule for a failure to meet a statute of limitations. It would seem to be beyond that member's power to influence if he, in fact, expires within the period. Does the PLF pay off on a claim like that, or maybe you don't know because you only found out about these prior instances?
I can't provide you anything anecdotal, but I've thought about this a lot in terms of what it does to litigation dynamics. I can see, for instance, where an attorney who might be ill, it could be argued by a plaintiff's lawyer in a legal malpractice claim that there was some negligence on the part of the attorney for not doing something, unless, of course, the attorney dies very suddenly. But, you know, there are creative lawyers, and things can happen. And I would say in this instance, this is a litigation reduction measure as well. It eliminates the possibility of malpractice claims.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yes, thank you. Any further questions from the committee? Looks like we don't have any, so you're excused. Thank you for your participation this morning.
Thank you.
Any further witnesses on Senate Bill 284? Seeing none, I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 284 and open a work session on Senate Bill 284. Chair will move that Senate Bill 284 be forwarded to the full committee with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion or objections to the motion? Okay, hearing none, the clerk may call the roll.
Representative Flores?
Aye.
Representative Gerard?
Aye.
Representative Worth, excuse. Chair Ackerman?
Aye.
Senate Bill 284 is forwarded to the full committee with a due pass recommendation, and I will be the carrier. And with that, we'll close the work session on Senate Bill 284 and open a work session on House Bill 2146. And I had a note on that one, and this came up relatively fast. It has to do, I believe, with Counsel, you explain the bill, and then I'll explain the bill and you can call the witnesses. We'll get it done somehow.
I'll go ahead and explain the bill. Representative Ackerman, Chair Ackerman, members of the committee, House Bill 2146 requires recipients of services from the DHS to execute an assignment of rights to the DHS for any claims for payment for medical care from a third party. You have before you dash 5 amendments. Those amendments address the concerns that were raised when this bill originally came before the subcommittee on May 16th in the dash 4 amendments. And specifically, I want to go through those amendments. They make several changes. First, they replace the term medical care with assistance in order to clarify that both general assistance and medical assistance are recoverable from liable third parties. Second, to clarify the applicant's assignment of rights, they clarify that the applicant's assignments of rights is limited to the amount of assistance paid by DHS. I provide that an applicant must cooperate with DHS to pursue third-party claims unless it is in the best interest of the applicant not to do so. That amendment changes the term good cause and uses the term best interest. Fourth, the amendments authorize DHS to allow prepaid managed care health services, service organizations to pursue claims as an assignee for assistance paid by the MCO on behalf of the applicant. And finally, the amendments provide that the claim brought by DHS may not be used for the purpose of issue or claim preclusion in subsequent proceedings. There are a couple other minor issues that need to be addressed, and it's my understanding that the parties have agreed to deal with these, I guess they're described as technical changes in the second chamber.
Okay, let me just explain. I got a note that some persons interested in the bill did not have a chance to see the Dash 5 amendments until right now, and they'd like an opportunity to comment. I'm willing to, with the committee's permission, provide an opportunity for them to give some invited testimony on the Dash 5 amendments. Can we proceed without objection on that? Okay, then I'll invite Gwen Dayton, Richard Lane, Lauren Rhodes, to come forward. I don't know if you all want to speak on the Dash 5s, but if somebody could summarize what the issue is. If you need more time, I can certainly sit over the work session until another date certain.
Chair Ackerman, for the record, my name is Gwen Dayton. I'm General Counsel for the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems. And I will be brief this morning, but indicate that we have been working with the department for months, literally since January, February of this year, on this bill to try to develop a bill that would work for them. Frankly, this is a bill that the department needs, not particularly a bill that the providers have an interest in, but we've been working in good faith with the department to help them develop a bill that gives them what they need while avoiding some of those unintended consequences that we all fear in bills like this. And we felt we had a consensus around amendments, I think it was last week, and I was quite disappointed this morning to arrive on another issue and be given the Dash 5 amendments. Apparently, the department worked with others, not providers, last week in developing these amendments. They do seem to retreat to a previous position of the department that the providers had expressed their objection to. We've always been concerned that this bill would inadvertently, I don't think the department is trying to do this, but inadvertently establish an independent cause of action with the department. And these Dash 5 amendments do appear to retreat to that position, and we are concerned about that. We wish that we had an opportunity to express that concern prior to today. Thank you.
I don't think I'm focusing on your issue. What's your major concern again? I'm just not following it.
Sure. Our concern, let me back up a little bit. I don't mean to speak for the department, and I certainly hope that they will indicate if I have misspoken, but my understanding is that they need a bill to bring them in compliance with federal law that provides for an assignment of right from a Medicaid recipient to the department, so the department can then go on behalf of, pursuant to this assignment, can bring a claim against a provider or someone else who may have caused injury to this recipient if the recipient themselves is not exercising that right. An example would be if since I speak from the hospital perspective, I suppose if a Medicaid recipient was in a hospital and suffered damages, if the recipient themselves did not enforce that right, the department would have the right to go back and bring a claim against the hospital for the amount of assistance that was paid by the Medicaid program for this person's care.
Let me see if I understand. Are you advocating for a position that medical providers who may be negligent should not be subject to these subrogation claims?
Chair Ackerman, absolutely not. We are advocating for, this is not our bill to begin with, but what we hope this bill will do is basically reflect what federal law says, and that's what the last amendments did. Frankly, they were drafted in my office and submitted for comment by all parties, and they basically reiterate federal law about the right, that a recipient will provide an assignment of rights. The department can then act pursuant to that assignment. These amendments that, again, we've only had a brief chance to look at appear to go beyond that by saying the department may make a claim to recover the amount of assistance that the department is, rather than reacting or acting pursuant to an assignment, that they can apparently act on their own. And that is beyond the requirements of federal law, and the provider community does not think that that is acceptable, and it's not even what the department, as they've articulated to us, is attempting to do.
Okay. Ms. Rhodes?
Chair Ackerman, members of the committee, for the record, Lauren Rhodes. I represent the Oregon Healthcare Association, a group of long-term care facilities across the state of Oregon. And as I testified last week on this bill, we have been working in conjunction with the Hospital Association with the department since January in various meetings and conversations, and had arrived at what we thought were a workable agreement. And based on that, having just gotten the Dash 5 amendments this morning, we are concerned with where the end result is at this point in time, and are willing to work again with the department and their attorneys to try and reach an agreement. We just wanted to say on the record that this isn't exactly where we thought we were last week, and having not been included in those discussions, just wanted to make reference on the record that we do still have existing concerns.
I know, but you're not focusing in on what your concern is.
As I said, Mr. Chair Ackerman, we are also concerned about the independent cause of action that the department would have should the language as currently drafted go forth against healthcare providers, including long-term care facilities, should the department pursue an independent claim absent the recipients doing so on their own.
I'm having a hard time focusing on that issue. I don't know if a member of the committee have any questions or can follow what their concern is.
A question?
Yes, counsel.
Maybe Ms. Dayton or Ms. Rhodes, maybe you could point to the specific language in the Dash 5 amendments that goes beyond the Dash 4 amendments that allows this cause of action where it is different from the Dash 4 amendments, so the committee can consider that.
Certainly, Chair Ackerman, Council Sears, we look at subsection 4 of section 2.
Don't go too fast.
I'm sorry.
Let's get on the same page. Where are we?
First page of the proposed amendment.
Yeah, sub 4 of section 2.
Yeah, line 19. It says the department may make a claim to recover the amount of assistance that the department paid for the benefit of an applicant or recipient. All that we would want in that section to make it work better is a reference back to the assignment section, or the assignment subsection. So if that is said, the department may make a claim to recover the amount of assistance pursuant to the assignment referenced in, or better words than that perhaps, in subsection 2 of this section, then I think we'd be fine. But it doesn't. It's a standalone section that appears to create an independent cause of action. That's why we wish we'd actually been included in the discussion and we wouldn't have to be going through this.
Right. So it looks like it's standalone authority without the assignment, I think is what you're saying.
And I don't even think that's what anybody intends, but that's the way it
is. No, I don't think it was either, and that's a relevant issue. Okay, thank you for that clarification. Thank you, Council, for leading us into the answer. Mr. Lane?
Chair Ackerman, members of the committee, my name is Richard Lane. I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association. We followed HB 2146 through its inception, but have not been an active participant in many of the work group sessions. We saw the Dash 4 and actually looked favorable on those Dash 4 amendments, thought that they protected the department but didn't impact or prejudice any recipient or benefit beneficiary's ability to pursue a third-party action. The Dash 5, however, will lead to significant prejudice to a beneficiary, and it starts and flows from what's been identified as Section 2, Subsection 4, and the granting or creation of an independent right of action on behalf of the department. The way this Dash 5 works, then, is that after 12 months after an injury is suffered, the department itself can now give notice to a potential third-party defendant and the recipient that it intends to pursue its own claim. Now, as the committee is aware, that's 12 months before a beneficiary is entitled to bring an independent action under a two-year statute of limitation. It's easier if you go to page 2 of the Dash 5, at line 8, after the department gives the beneficiary notice of its intent to pursue a claim as drafted right now, the recipient is got 14 days to make a decision about he or she willingness to go forward with their own action. As a matter of practicality, that's impossible. To identify an attorney, to try to find out the facts surrounding whether you do or you do have a claim, you still have, under existing law right now, 12 months to get an action, but now you're being forced into 14 days. Now, the proponents have indicated they certainly will work with us. There was some discussion in the hall about 60 days and 45 days, so there's a number perhaps out there that might work that make that work better. But if you drop down to line 22 in subsection 6, then, if in the window where the department has given notice, and let's say it's 15 days, 30 days, 45 days, they go ahead and file their independent action, the beneficiary or the recipient still may have up to 8 months to pursue their own action. If they do file an action after the state has already filed their action, you're going to have competing actions present in one particular jurisdiction at that given time. That's going to lead to procedural problems of possible consolidation motions, and now you've got the collateral source issues in front of the jury actually dealing with the third-party claim. You've got accusations that there's been assertions for double recovery that are going to have to be sorted out. So looking at the dash 5 and talking again outside informally, perhaps there's some way that the state's action could be stayed or dismissed in the event that the recipient does file an action in a timely fashion under the two-year statute that's seeking to recover those benefits and is agreeing to repay those to the state so everybody's made whole. So there's some technical problems with 2146 and the grant of an independent cause of action to the department now. And that's a significant extension of existing law.
I know that was certainly not the intention of the bill or the amendments. And that can be corrected and fixed, but thank you for calling it to our attention.
Mr. Chair?
Yes. Who is responsible for the dash fives?
Good question.
There were several parties working together for the dash five amendments. DHS, there was a member from DOJ, a member from, I know Ronell, I can't remember the exactly who you represent, but Sybil Head was involved. I think she was in contact with Mr. Lane. I may be mistaken on that. Maybe not. Okay. I know Ms. Schenkel from DOJ can explain the process of the Dash 5 amendments and their how those were worked out, if you want further information on that.
Yes, I kind of would like to know why the people who proposed the Dash 5s didn't talk to anybody else.
Does anybody have the answer to that question can come forward. I will say, Representative Girard, that this happened very swiftly, and the people that did come together in the work group reached agreement on the Dash 5 relatively fast, which I thought was okay.
Well, if they were only meeting with their own group, Mr. Chair,
problems.
That shouldn't come as a surprise. If they weren't meeting with anybody else but themselves, that's why they came up with it very swiftly.
Yeah.
Chair Ackerman, members of the committee, for the record, Ron L. Schenkel with the Department of Justice, and in partial answer, at least to Representative Girard's question, this was not a Department of Justice bill, and I happened to be sitting in the room when it had its public hearing last week, and some of our attorneys were involved in providing advice on behalf of the state. I did help facilitate a work group. We got together that same day. The only people that were able to be together were DHS, Department of Justice, and Sybil Head from the Oregon Law Center. Most of the work after that point took place by email. I am not familiar with all the names of the people, so do not know who all was represented in the email chains. I believe there are some health managed care organizations. I understand from our conversations in the hallway, Ms. Rhodes was not involved. There was some contact with the Oregon trial lawyers, but not the representative that you have here today. So it did happen, as Jackman said, very quickly. All that we tried to facilitate were we were given a list of five specific assignments from this committee. We tried to put together conceptual solutions, and we took those conceptual solutions to legislative council
and you have the result such as it is today. I understand. I saw four attorneys standing in the hall. I am not one, by the way. Four attorneys standing in the hall, and none of them agree that all of the language is quite perfect that legislative counsel gave us. Nonetheless, that was the design by legislative counsel. So we are happy to continue to work on what I would qualify as technical amendments. I understand from Department of Human Services, from Roy Fredericks, who is in the room, that most of the technical issues he's hearing can be resolved. Some of the testimony I believe you just heard goes to the underlying policy choice that's before you as to whether or not DHS should be able to make a claim. The Dash 5's attempt to make that better and put parameters around it, but nonetheless, there's still a policy choice for you to make about whether or not that should go forward. So that's what I know about the process, and my apologies for the confusion.
And I think I may have had some part in trying to identify the issues for the work group, and they did discuss it with me. I was called out of the session once to see some of the progress report. I didn't see the final draft till this morning, but nonetheless, I mean, we're here to fix things, and it'd be my inclination, with the committee's permission, to set over the work session for, would a week be enough, folks, to get this fixed? I can only go to Wednesday or go to next Monday. Yeah, that's when the subcommittee meets.
Well, next Monday, I'm not sure we're in the building.
That's right, we're not here Monday, so Monday's a holiday. So somebody give me a time frame that so we don't have to sort of resolve it all at once.
Chair Ackerman, for the record, and Yaron L. Schenkel, Department of Human Services is indicating they can get together this week. Department of Justice will assist them within the interested parties. I would seek some direction from you to legislative counsel, perhaps, on what you would... Again, we submitted concepts, and this is the language that legislative counsel preferred. I don't know if you want us to direct language through you this time. Perhaps you could give us some direction on that.
Okay. I want to get a date shook out first. Okay, Monday is a holiday. It's either going to be Wednesday or a week from Wednesday.
Chair Ackerman, we can do it this week if you believe that legislative counsel can accommodate us.
I can't speak for legislative counsel, so I've got another problem.
Mr. Chair, maybe it would be appropriate to put a week from this coming Wednesday, and
yeah,
then give time for
then
all
then
the stakeholders to...
Then we'll be clear on it. What's that date? Anybody have that date?
31st
would be June
next Wednesday.
June 1?
The only concern I'd express, Mr. Chair, is that this is a House bill, so it still has to move quite a ways between before end of session. If we, plus when that much time elapses, one thing that happens to me is I kind of forget what the issues are. it might even be better to, since we're even to try to get it back on this coming Wednesday, day after tomorrow, if we could be noticed in time. And
well, that's probably the most prudent way, and if we're stuck, we'll set it over again. But let's try for a work session on Monday, on next Wednesday, and that date is
June 1st.
June 1st. So are we in accord on that? That we'll set over the work session until June 1 on this bill.
One other solution would be to bring it to the full committee on Friday to adopt the amendments there, but that's just another solution.
That's a good idea, considering the timeline we've got.
That takes us another step closer. Okay, and that would be, we could do that on Friday then, correct?
Yes.
All right. Then the consensus, I believe, is to set over... Do you wish to speak?
Yeah,
all right.
Sure. For the record, I'm Bruce Bishop, appearing on behalf of the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems. Another alternative the committee could consider would be to move the Dash 4s to keep the bill moving now and then have an opportunity to further deliberate on additional changes, including perhaps further modifications to the Dash 5s once we've had a chance to look and review those.
In fact, that was going to be my suggestion, Mr. Chair, is that we move it, if we move it up to full, that we move it with the Dash 4s, so we've got something that has a general consensus for as far as it goes, and then if there's a further change that seems advised, then to move in amendments at full.
Well, why would we do that if there's going to be a fix to the Dash 5s, which would yield a Dash 6?
It's just a question of whether it makes sense to... It would appear there's a need to act because of the federal law requirement, the Dash 4s, as far as they go, seem to have a broad consensus behind them, so we're moving a product that's relatively in better shape up to full, is all.
Mr. Chair, I don't know. I just have a note that I would not accept the Dash 4s.
Okay. Well, then I think we should do is just what's the consensus and bring it back to the full committee on Friday and hope that we can get a consensus amendment then. That's the probably more expedient way to do it. Mm-hmm. Okay. Without objection, then, this will be set over till the full committee for a work session on next Friday. And the issues are those regarding the page 1, line 19, the freestanding ability of the department to make a claim. The second issue we have to resolve is a 14-day requirement on page 2 at line 7. And third was the duplication of litigation that was foreseen in line 22 of page 2. Those are three issues that we are going to consider. Does that take care of it, and do you have your direction? Okay, with that, I will adjourn the work session until...
Don't we need a motion to move it to the full committee?
I think we do. Yes, we do. So the chair will move that House Bill 2146 be forwarded to the full committee, with the anticipation that we would have Dash 6 amendment. Any objection? Done. That's good. And with that, I'll conclude the work session on House Bill 2146. And the last bill this morning is House Bill 2591. And I'll open a work session on that bill. Council?
Chair Ackerman, members of the committee, House Bill 2591 is before this civil subcommittee March 9th. This bill prohibits persons from bringing a cause of action for food-related conditions against those involved with selling food. Food-related conditions are described and defined in the bill. It further provides exceptions for which causes of action may be brought by those suffering from food-related conditions, and it sets out pleading requirements for actions regarding food-related conditions. You have before you the Dash 1 amendments. These are consensus amendments that the parties worked out. They make some changes to the bill. First, they define food in accordance with the federal statutes. Second, they provide for civil immunity only for those involved in selling the food, not those involved with marketing or advertising in food. And third, they clarify the actions to which the exceptions of the bill apply.
Thank you. This is a work session, and I just want to confirm that we do have a consensus on the Dash 1 amendments, because what's happening, we're having public hearings, then we're going into work session, then we get amendments upon which we haven't heard very much from the proponents. So do we have any person who'd like to speak to that? And I'll, without objection, take some invited testimony from Mr. Linden and Mr. Lane.
Mr. Chairman, for your record, Bill Linden, representing the Oregon Restaurant Association. I appreciate an opportunity to briefly comment on the Dash 1s. These are the result of discussions we've had since the subcommittee first heard this issue with Mr. Lane and his colleagues with the Oregon Trial Lawyer Association. And counsel very accurately described what the major changes are here. We've decided to go with a commonly understood and accepted definition of food that's found in the federal code. We've also narrowed the definition of food-related condition that was in the original bill. And we've also provided that in the section of the bill, which in the Dash 1s is on page 3, subsection 3, that deals with discovery in these types of cases, that there is an opportunity for parties to obtain discovery when they, on motion and for good cause shown, bring forward the compelling reasons why the court ought to allow discovery. One of the changes that was made there was we had the court originally in the original version with discretionary authority to order discovery in certain instances. This substitutes the word shall for the word may. In discussions Friday afternoon and this morning with Mr. Lane, we found a couple of other changes that we think would enhance the bill. And these have to do with, if you look at section 1, line 4 on page 1, right now the definition of food is defined as the term given in 21 U.S. Code 321 sub F. Actually, 321 has a more comprehensive definition of food, and we would recommend that in two places in the bill where F is referenced, that F be dropped and that it just simply read 21 U.S.C. 321 as a more comprehensive definition of food. We also, if you move to page 2, section 2, we did not intend this bill to be retroactive in any context. We meant it to apply prospectively. And in section 2, sub 1, we would suggest changing the language to this act applies to all actions filed or commenced, whatever word legislative council prefers, filed or commenced on or after the effective date of the act. And if you go to section 4, again, if we're going to use the word filed, it's already in there. If we're going to switch to the word commenced, we'd want to conform that as well. So those are the suggestions we have. And there is one more, I'm sorry, on page 3, subsection 3, 2B. We recommend deletion of the word material. That would then read, the facts that are alleged to constitute a violation of the law. Adding in the word material would open up a whole new area of disagreement and likely litigation. And so that is a deletion that we think is very, very important to have occur. And I had talked with counsel earlier this morning, Mr. Chairman, whatever the subcommittee's preference is, we could ask you to adopt the dash ones as written and then bring in a second set of amendments that deal with just these few additional issues we've identified, or we could bring to you a comprehensive set of amendments, assuming the subcommittee is ready to move this bill forward. I'm sure they could be ready in time for the full committee on Friday, and I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Mr. Lane?
Chair Ackerman, members of the committee, my name is Richard Lane. I am here on behalf of the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association. We've worked with a number of the proponents' interest groups on what is reduced to 2591-1. I don't see a huge litigation problem associated with weight and obesity, but they have some concerns. We have tried mightily to accommodate their interests and get a bill, and with Mr. Linden's identified corrections that need to be made, effective date and the material deletion, then dash one does reflect those conversations that we've had.
So you're in favor of the dash ones as written?
In favor of the dash ones with the identified changes that Mr. Linden just...
Are you accepting those changes? I'm trying to understand.
I'm suggesting most of those changes that he's identified.
All right. So basically we're more together than I think you are.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, we are in agreement as to what the bill should look like.
All right. So it'd be your preference to move it to the full committee with a work session with the anticipation of another amendment?
Mr. Chairman, that would be my suggestion. If you adopt the dash ones, then we will have a second set of amendments ready for the full committee that just deal with the food definition issue,
okay,
the effective date issue, and then the deletion of the word material.
All right, then, if I understand the consensus, we'll move forward and adopt the dash ones and forward it to the full committee. And you'll come back and perhaps we'll have another amendment to consider at that level. Is that where we are? Okay.
Well, I have a question, though.
Yes,
one
yes sure, go ahead.
Chair, and I guess this appears to be part of a kind of a general trend that we're seeing, which is various industries are looking at the possibility of litigation, and in this case, I think litigation that hasn't even occurred, and asking for protection from the possibility of that litigation. And so I'm curious that while the trial lawyers apparently helped shape the Dash 1 amendments and that those make the bill more acceptable, what's your view about the overall policy choice that's being reflected in the bill itself?
Representative McPherson, Chair Ackerman, members of the committee, I am troubled by attempting to carve out certain immunities for hypothetical, anticipated problems somewhere down the road that may materialize. That said, I'm aware of one case in the entire country that has survived motions to dismiss and or summary judgment, and it's a case out of New York that is alive only because of a particular provision inside the state of New York's Unlawful Trade Practice Act that has to do with representations. That's the only case I know of out there that still has legs today. So why is this bill in front of you? This bill has been modified from its original 2591 introduction to minimize the effect, preserve adulteration claims, preserve misrepresentation claims, and is designed to eliminate a very narrow type of action, those brought because you eat too many cheeseburgers. And with that said, it's a pure balancing agreement here, Representative Ackerman, McPherson.
Thank you,
Mr. Chair.
Okay, further questions from the committee? Seeing none, thank you for your work and for your testimony. I think we have some direction. Any further witnesses on House Bill 2591? Seeing none, I'll close the... I don't have to close anything. We're in work session, aren't we? The chair will move the Dash 1 amendments into the Bill 2591. Any discussion or objection? That's allowed. Chair will move House Bill 2591 as amended to the full committee with a due pass recommendation with the anticipation that the Dash 2 amendments will be submitted to the full committee during that work session. Is there any discussion on the motion? Seeing none, the clerk may call the roll.
Representative Flores?
Aye.
Representative Garrard?
Aye.
Representative Garrard?
Aye. House Bill 2591, as amended, is forwarded to the full committee. We do pass recommendation with anticipation of Dash 2 amendment at that time.
Who's the carrier?
Excuse me?
Who's the carrier on that?
I'll carry it. And I'll conclude the work session on that bill. Further business before the committee, council.
I just had one question on 2146. We sent it to the full committee. I can't recollect if it was a due pass recommendation or if it was passed without recommendation or what I'm not sure what the committee wanted to do on that. We didn't adopt any of the amendments. I was going to suggest that we pass it without recommendation, that we would be looking at the dash sixes, I guess, in the full committee. But I can't, we didn't take a roll vote on it. We didn't.
Okay. Are we in consensus that 2146 is forwarded with no recommendation?
Pending receipt and review of the dash six amendments.
Correct. Okay. Is that our consensus? Okay, let the record show that. Thank you. Further business before the committee? Thank you all. We're adjourned.